It's time to turn the spotlight on local, national, and international affairs, plus some goss and scandal. And here's the man that does that so well, Mitchell Dye. Brought to you by Corio Waste Management, station sponsor.
And good morning.
It's great to be here on a Monday morning for Mitchell's Front Page. Always look forward to the start of the week here at 94.7 The Pulse, and there's plenty to talk about this week and this morning, and I wanted to talk about the Gippsland South by-election result, which you heard on our news service there at 9 o'clock, which took place over the course of the weekend. I mean, a lot of people in Geelong might say that there's not much relevance to them, except that the ramifications do apply to our state-level politics, and there's a bit of a feedback on how the various parties are going. Now, the election in Gippsland South was caused by Peter Ryan, the former Deputy Premier and Nationals leader, resigning after that result in November. So, for the good people of Gippsland South, it was back to the polls to vote again, and of course, just a few months later, after already casting their votes in November. Now, I wonder how the people of Geelong would take it if they had to go back to the ballot box and vote again just a couple of months on. Now, Labor made the very good move of not running a candidate in this election. They decided that early on, and I think it's the right call. I mean, the last state government did exactly the same thing when they were sort of questioning whether to run candidates in Broadmeadows and the Lyndhurst by-elections. They got criticised for it at the time, but I mean, why turn it into an referendum on the Andrews government when there's pretty much no chance of the Labor Party winning those very conservative held seats? And there's always going to be a swing against the government in a by-election. That's just what happens. People protest against what happens, and you would expect a swing against the government that's elected in a change of government election. So you would just expect there to be a swing against the government. It's a very wise move of Labor not to run a candidate. I mean, 105 days is not really enough time to judge the Andrews government, but just a smart move to not let people get that opportunity. But the Liberals decided 3 weeks out to run their own candidate in this by-election. They decided that that was going to be worth their while. They've got this agreement with the Nationals, which determines which seats are which and when they can run candidates. And according to the agreement, if someone stands down, the Liberals and the Nationals can go head-to-head to see who'll take the seat. So the main players in that Gippsland South by-election were Danny O'Brien from the Nationals, you had Scott Rossetti from the Liberals, Andrea Milsom from the Greens, and a whole host of independents who always seem to come out of the woodwork at by-elections. Now, Gippsland South is one of the Nationals' safest seats. It's been held by the Nationals for 33 years, and before that it was Liberal for about 4 years. So there was no surprise in the final result, in my view. I mentioned this last week and predicted that Danny O'Brien would be the member for Gippsland South after the course of the weekend, and that's exactly what's happened. But there was an 11% swing against the Nationals. However, I think that's just the fact that the Liberals were running this time, and some of the Nationals' votes went to the Liberals. Also, there's a bit of a protest there. People a little bit angry that the Nationals, they voted for Peter Ryan, and he stood down, and they have to go back to the polls. So maybe a slight turn against the Nationals there. However, what surprised me, and what I think the biggest take-out message from this election, and this is where it's relevant to the people of Geelong, is perhaps in the Greens' vote. Now, in November, Labor got 17% of the vote in this election of Gippsland South, and that just shows, by the way, how conservative that part of the world is for the Labor Party to only get 17%. But you would expect a sizeable amount of that 17% to go to the Greens when there's no Labor candidate running, given that there are a lot of similar values between the various parties. However, out there in Gippsland South over the weekend, the Greens' vote only went up by 6%. So they had the opportunity to get 17% of that Labor vote, and they only managed to get 6%. Now, I've been reading all sorts of commentary on this election, a lot of it coming from the Greens, giving themselves the big tick because they got more votes. But I just think it's interesting that if you can't manage to get votes from Labor people, who mostly put the Greens second anyway when they decide to vote for the Labor Party, then what's going on there? I mean, it's just interesting that most Labor votes seem to go to the Liberals and a slight increase to the Independents, but it seemed like most Labor votes went to the Liberal Party. Now, I've spoken to people that were on the ground there at that election, and they said that the Greens ran a very strong campaign down there with a focus on fracking and coal seam gas. And, of course, in that part of the world with lots of farmers owning their land and wondering what's going to happen, coal seam gas and fracking is a very sensitive topic. And there are a lot of people urging the community to vote Green down there, a lot of community advocates and a lot of respected community members, because of the Greens' strong stance on fracking. I mean, the major parties, it's a bit confusing as to where they lie sometimes, but the Greens, you probably know and probably would expect them to just have a complete no to all fracking. So it's just interesting, and even the VEC, the Victorian Electoral Commission, was surprised because they declare who they think the two main candidates are going to be at 6 p.m. to work out the preferences, and they said that the two main candidates of that Gippsland South by-election would be the Nationals and the Greens. But that turned out to be wrong, because the main candidates were Nationals and the Liberals, so they had to change that. The Greens ended up being a distant third. So even the Greens' results surprised the VEC, who were expecting the Greens to get more. Interesting. Some out there are also saying that the result is bad for Daniel Andrews, just because 75% of the electorate voted either Liberal or National, and they're calling this a return to the Conservative vote. This is a massive result for 75%, but I don't think you can really draw that conclusion in saying that it's against the Andrews government without having a Labour candidate there on the ground. And of course, the Liberal vote would have drawn some people in. But apropos to that, the fracking issue, it's very difficult to follow who supports what, and a lot of people won't answer the question on fracking. I mean, first of all, the federal government won't touch it. They want the states to decide on fracking. Now, last year, I spoke to Sarah Henderson about it, had to ask that question, and this is what she said when I asked her.
What is your position on fracking?
I am concerned about fracking in small regional communities. No matter the development, it's got to be in the right area.
So fracking could happen in some areas, but not in those certain communities?
Well, really importantly, the Napthine government have absolutely taken the lead on this.
So in that occasion, it was pretty much a handball straight to the state government and saying, well, it's up to them to decide. And she was saying that they've taken the lead on it because they put a moratorium on fracking, the previous government. But it is confusing because the Napthine government said no to fracking. And now the state Liberal position, I would say, is probably less clear, mainly because they're not in government. And from Labor, and we spoke to Lily D'Ambrosio about this a few months ago, she said that there is a review underway into the science behind fracking, and we'll find out what happens as a result of that review, which may determine that some areas could be fracked. So, yeah, you would expect the Liberal Party to be a bit more relaxed on fracking, but it seems that Labor are the ones leaving the door open to it. Now, the Nationals also sent out a letter to voters in Gippsland South saying that they were against fracking, but the Greens were the ones that were running the hardest on the issues. They said, we say no to gas, or something similar on their hard-to-vote cards. However, despite that strong view and the strong stance against fracking in those communities, the votes just didn't flow, in my opinion. So, in my view on fracking, let's see what the science says when this Labour review is complete, because I think there's a lot of vested interest from both sides of the community. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the Labour review says about fracking, and I think that's going to be out in a few months' time. But I think the biggest issue on fracking is just being fair to landowners and farmers, in my view, and what happens when we destroy or impact on prime agricultural land. So, as Sarah Henderson said, you have to choose the right area if you're going to go ahead with it. Now, another strange issue with the parties not necessarily going for what their philosophies might suggest would be the one of cage fighting. Now, Labor has, of course, moved and legislated to reallow cage fighting in Victoria. And you would expect, logically, based on the party's philosophies, that Labor would be the ones to ban it and the coalition would allow it. But, in fact, it's the reverse. Now, the pictures were used very quickly from that fight that took place in Melbourne over the course of the weekend. One of the participants involved in the first fight was a Geelong local. The pictures just look intense, like any blood wound. I mean, they always seem to have blood running down their faces in this cage fighting, which certainly changes people's perceptions of what's going on. Many people say that the sport is gratuitous violence, and they don't like it. And people are, of course, also concerned about the impacts on those that may become desensitized to violence, like our youths, of course. I mean, I really sit on the fence when it comes to cage fighting, because I'm not fully across what's involved. I've not seen a cage fight ever, and I don't really want to. I mean, I don't like it, of course. It's not a sport that I would naturally gravitate to, but I don't think we should ban things just because some people don't like it. Now, I read about it in The Age yesterday, and it said there that parents even took kids to see the fight. So if the parents there are taking kids to see this cage fighting, then what's the problem if parents that are supposedly making the right call think it's okay for kids to be there? I mean, at the end of the day, I suppose cage fighting is just two consenting adults who choose to get into that fighting arena or cage or ring or wherever they fight, knowing the risks. And we could desensitize kids to violence for going and seeing that sort of behavior. But I mean, where do you draw the line between that and other martial arts and other sources of violence, like violent video games and movies? And of course, with sports like boxing, I think they can even mount an argument to say that it reduces violence because it teaches people to let their frustrations out in a controlled and healthy environment. I think sports are a great medium for bringing people together, and of course we love a bit of healthy competition as long as it's safe and controlled. So I could definitely see the argument saying that it should only be stopped for extreme cases, and whether or not that applies to cage fighting, I'm not sure. I'll be asking Monday Sport about this after 10:30 this morning. Stephanie Asher will also be joining us for her regular Monday segment in the studio after 10 o'clock. She will have more to say on cage fighting. I wonder which side of the fence she will be on there. She also raised a very interesting question, and we'll be posing this after 10 o'clock, which is about primary school homework. Should kids in primary school have to do homework? And if so, how much? Now, of course, I'm not a parent, but it is interesting and concerning to see research showing that Australian kids are falling behind their overseas counterpart. This is the PISA results, which came through last year, which showed us slipping down in the key criteria of literacy and numeracy. And I mean, you do have to get the balance right there between study and having well-rounded individuals, though. So it's a difficult decision. And of course, putting kids in for hours and hours each night, particularly at primary school level, would not necessarily translate into better educational outcomes, I wouldn't think. So it's an interesting discussion. I'm sure everyone has their own feedback. I'd probably say that kids at primary school should do homework a bit later on in the primary school years, probably the second half, but we'll see what Stephanie Ash has to say. We'll have a bit of a chat about that after 10 o'clock. Now, also over the weekend, I was reading the Geelong Advertiser online and saw a very interesting article concerning Avalon Airport and the fact that people are perhaps bypassing Avalon that live in Geelong, because from Avalon at the moment you can only fly to Sydney. The last Brisbane flight was I think about this time last year, so from Avalon Airport you can only fly direct to Sydney if you want to go with Jetstar. There are some smaller airlines which fly to Warrnambool and Port Fairy and that sort of thing, but according to Jetstar's own booking data, people in some Geelong suburbs, as many as 15%, could be just driving straight past Avalon to fly Jetstar from Tullamarine. And of course, I think about 25% of Werribee residents were choosing Tullamarine over Avalon. Now, Avalon, in my view, used to be a very unpleasant place to fly from, because you had to drive down that very long stretch of road to get there at 15 k's an hour or something, going over speed humps. And there's only one way in and one way out of that airport. And of course, you stop there at that curbside drop-off area for about 30 seconds or something, and you sort of drop the person off and they get their bags. Anyway, by that time security was already giving me hassling gestures and coming up to the car and saying you have to move on. So it's not really a pleasant place to fly from. When it's a country airport, you should be getting a lot better service there compared to Tullamarine. However, to Avalon's credit, in recent times, they seem to have realised that if they want people to use it, they should start acting like a local and community airport, like a small business, providing a bit more personalised service. What I think was great there was when I was there earlier this year, and they had free 45-minute parking. That is a very good gesture towards saying that we are listening and we are giving people much better service. So free 45-minute parking is a big win for me, especially relative to Tullamarine Airport. And now it seems, according to their Facebook page, that free Wi-Fi is the latest perk for those travelling, which is also great, although I do believe you can get that in the Qantas terminals at Tullamarine. But at Tullamarine, of course, you've got that host of amenities there, some great shops, the Qantas Club for those enrolled there. Whereas, of course, Avalon, it's pretty boring to just sit there and wait with not much to do once you go airside. So I just wish that they'd started doing some of these great community things a little bit earlier on in the piece when they had two airlines flying out. Of course, Tiger was flying there, and some of the routes included Brisbane and Perth. I wish that they'd started thinking about some of the community-minded things that they could have done then, rather than waiting till now when things are looking pretty dire. However, the paper was referring to the Sydney flights from Avalon, and it said that all the flights to Sydney pretty much had very solid loads. And I speak to people that do that Sydney-Melbourne run from Avalon, and the vibe seems to be from them as well, that the flights are packed. There's not much room. It's very lucky if you get sort of two seats to yourself there. So the issue doesn't seem to necessarily be with the numbers using that Jetstar service from Avalon to Sydney. It seems to be more of a question of Jetstar. I think it's a problem with them, perhaps, because they say that they are losing money on that route, despite some good loads and busy flights. Jetstar say that they're still losing money between Avalon and Sydney, and quite a substantial amount as well. So despite the high passenger numbers, something must be wrong there in terms of how they're conducting their airline business. And I've said before many times, you wouldn't want to be involved in the airline business. It's a very difficult one. But I would really want to see Avalon continue on as a passenger airport where people can, from this region, go there and fly to Sydney. Much better than having to drive to Tullamarine for those people that just want to get on a plane and get to their final destination, not too worried about the experience on the flight. But I just don't want to see the government having to step in and subsidise flights, because this is the vibe that I was getting from this article, saying that we're still waiting to hear from the state government, and Jetstar's having talks with the state government about whether or not they can continue that Avalon to Sydney route. And it's not really a route that I would like to go down in terms of having to rely on government money to keep the airlines open. I mean, if the numbers are there and the numbers of people are flying and want that service, then it's really up to Jetstar to run a profitable service. Otherwise, there's no point keeping that service at all. If you can't make a profit when the service is packed out on every flight, then there's something wrong. Why would you keep subsidising that service? Unless you have a really clear plan and a clear strategy to get to a profitable service, not relying on government funding. But another big problem there is we just need to see more destinations, because not everyone wants to fly to Sydney. A lot of people would rather go to Brisbane or the Gold Coast or over to the west. And according to Anthony, he says, I bypass Avalon to go to Queensland without a stupid Sydney stopover. It's a shame. It would be great to be able to fly from there rather than spend an extra hour and a half on the road, according to Anthony. Samantha says the biggest reason why she is not using Avalon is that the flight times aren't conducive to when she needs to get to the destination. She says, Avalon flight times are stupid. Make them at better hours and people would use it. And according to Peter, he says, stop blaming us locals. If you had direct flights like you used to, we would use it more. Do you really think we'd all like to drive that extra hour through traffic to Tulla? Just put more flights to more destinations. What happened to Perth, Brisbane and Adelaide flights? They used to be full. Stop blaming us, says Peter. And these are all very valid points. And they're not points that can be fixed by the government throwing money at that airport. If the Jetstar business model is not profitable, then it doesn't matter how much government money is thrown at that airport, I would have thought. But anyway, interesting thoughts there. And I'd be interested to hear what any listeners have to say. Of course, you can give us a call on 5222 5947, or get in touch via the website, mitchellsfrontpage.com. That'll link you through to our Facebook page and Twitter and all that sort of thing, mitchellsfrontpage.com. But are you bypassing Avalon? Do you fly from Avalon? How would it affect you if Avalon Airport ended up going and you had to fly from Tullamarine? But at the same time, I would love to see Avalon open, but I just don't think that government subsidies are the way to have a sustainable business. 23 after 9.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.